ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Dr. Shiworju Mukherjee. He's an assistant professor at the marketing department at Audencia Business School in France. He's a consumer researcher who specializes in behavioral issues in marketing, and his current projects focus on understanding how brand activism shapes consumer-brand relationships, the effects of consumers' morality and political ideology on their brand evaluations, and the effect of new media and technologies on consumer behavior. Shiworju, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Your current projects range from how brand activism shapes consumer brand relationships to how new media and technologies affect consumers. However, for the purposes of today's conversation, we're going to focus on brand activism and its impact on consumer behavior and what that means for brands and also how they might want to manage things if spokespeople or company officials inadvertently land them in the public eye. Now, in conversations, we sometimes see a blending, at least conceptually, of corporate social responsibility with brand activism. But while they may exist on a spectrum, they're actually different things. And certainly for the purposes of this conversation, we're speaking very specifically about brand activism. Can you take listeners through the differences between the two things?
Sure. I think that's a very basic and important differentiation. So if we look at what has been studied, the kind of topics that companies have engaged in when it comes to corporate social responsibility, it's mostly issues that widely most parts of the population would consider to be universally good. Obviously, you may have some people disagreeing with it, but we are going by the general consensus. Now, what is comparatively new in the last 5-10 years at max is companies are engaging with issues that are highly polarizing. So more controversial issues. If I take some examples in the context of the US, this will be gun control. This can be issues concerning immigration and citizenship or abortion rights. Mm-hmm. One can look at the same issue and say this is a corporate transgression, so unethical behavior, or some may look at it and say, no, this is actually a very responsible thing to do, the very responsible thing to kind of highlight in society. So the polarization is one of the key things.
Great. So really, when we're talking about brand activism, it's something that's an issue that's been politicized and there has this polarized opinion around it. For your research, you created a framework that created the foundation for your hypotheses, and it involved the concept of morality and a consumer's personal identity. And I think it's useful for people to understand that framework as it can help them to remember the findings. Can you take us through that framework?
Sure. So since we are looking at issues where some people might be against it, some people might be for it, so we look at it from what we call a morally pluralist framework, a moral disagreement, an issue where society is yet to come to consensus about what is morally right versus what is morally wrong. Mm-hmm. And now, for us individuals, the basic value judgment of right versus wrong is very fundamental. It's one of the core central parts of our identity, what we hold as to be right versus what we hold as to be purely wrong. So when a brand takes a position on an issue, it kind of shows how much we share, the part of our identity we share with the brand, how much of an overlap there is versus how different we are. And this identification with a brand or disidentification has a very strong influence on the final behavior.
Right, of course. I mean, really, that's fascinating that this right versus wrong really does go to that core personal identity. And thus it makes sense that if a brand winds up on the wrong side of that, you're going to have some dissonance around that because of the consumer sense of self and their identity. So going from there, you developed several hypotheses about consumer behavior and brand activism. And what I'd like to do is break these down and see what your research determined. So I'm going to read what was in the scientific paper. First, the effect of brand activism on consumer attitudes, intentions, and behavior is asymmetric. That is, negative in the case of disagreement with a brand stand and no effect in the case of agreement. And then a related secondary hypothesis, the level of consumer brand identification mediates the negative effect of consumer brand disagreement on consumer attitudes, intentions, and behaviors. Now, first, imagine we're at a cocktail party. Can you say that to me in a way that, as a layperson, it's gonna make sense very quickly and very easily? Can you simplify it?
So let me take a very easy example. If you're at a party and you see somebody stealing a very expensive ashtray at the party, would you say that person is moral or immoral?
Immoral.
Yeah. And if you see somebody not stealing the ashtray, would you suddenly say that?
I don't think anything about them. Right. Exactly.
Yes,
I see.
Exactly. So that is, so because the expectation is that you will behave morally. And in this case, when it comes to brand activism, because different people have different moral standards, everybody is expecting brands to be in line with what they automatically, by default, think is the right thing to do. So when you do the right thing, it's just like for not stealing, you're not going to get an additional reward. I'm not going to suddenly say, oh, what a beautiful, moral, ethical brand they are. But if you steal, then it kind of shows that you are definitely immoral. There is no other proof required. So that is why there is this huge asymmetry in the effects that we expect.
So it's almost like risk management, right? Like, we don't cheer that the plane landed, we get upset the plane hit the ground.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, did your research, because obviously this is your hypothesis, but then you put it through its paces, did your research find that these things were borne out?
Exactly. So we conducted, overall in the paper, we conducted 5 studies where the initial two, three studies were focused on testing this hypothesis. Now, whenever we say we find a significant effect, statistically speaking, we are looking at a 95% confidence interval and testing based on that. Mm. And we repeatedly find in multiple experiments the same thing over and over again, that whenever brands, whenever we see that consumers encountered a brand which has taken a stand on a particular issue and they agreed with the issue, the positive effect of that was statistically not significant. Whereas the negative effect was very large. And this plays out not only in what they say in terms of attitudes, if you ask them, but in terms of their willingness to give up financial incentive, additional bonus incentive, to punish the brand, which they disagree with. It is seen in their actual choice between two brands. So the effect is quite strong that we find multiple times across studies.
So what's fun about this is that these two hypotheses were what initially caught my attention and why we're actually talking today, because in an earlier episode of our podcast, I had interviewed Mary Lee Bliss of Y-Pulse about their surveys of young consumers. And
yes,
the survey was around consumer behaviors around brand activism. And I wanted to understand and share how their survey results could square up with your results. So to quickly refresh, what they had found was that over 60% of young consumers reported actively seeking out brands that support their causes that they believe in, and that they actively avoided brands that opposes the cause that they support and the brands didn't, and that they also look up the brand stance on their causes. Now, actively avoiding the negative, the the brands that are negative on their issues, it seems in line with the hypothesis. However, I'm curious about the active support piece. What do you think?
So here are two aspects to the issue. The first is whether brands are doing it because there is a strong demand from the companies. Okay, let me rephrase that. So the first question here is, do consumers actually want brands to take positions in such issues? Or is this driven by some other aspect?
I see.
In that case, the study that you're referring to, they're exactly right. Over time, more and more people, and especially young people, want brands to take a stand about issues that they care about. They want them to show what they stand for. So there is a real pressure towards that.
So in our cocktail party example, this would be, I want you to tell me you're not stealing, in a way, right? That's
Yes. You can put it like that. So that's very interesting. And like you said, that where they actively avoid versus actively choose. So here it's the question about the decision-making process. So in any consumer behavior, when we choose what brand to buy versus what brand we won't buy, there are different ways that we go about that, right? In some cases, we have three different features that we care about and we weigh our importance of the feature versus the score that a particular brand will get on that feature, and so on and so forth. In this case, what we see is, you can call it, if based on the result, I put it in more layman terms, it's almost like taking the right stand on an issue is like a hygiene factor. So if you take the right stand, that's good. You are in my consideration set. If you do not take the right stand, and if you are against what I believe in, you are immediately out of my consideration set.
Right. Okay. So now let's look at the next set of hypotheses. The first, the source of a brand's stance moderates the negative effect of consumer brand disagreement on attitude toward the brand, such that when the relationship between the brand and the source of the stand is more distant, it reduces the negative effect of the consumer brand disagreement. And second hypothesis, the source of a brand's stand influences the consumer's moral reasoning strategy, such that when the relationship between the brand and the source of the stand is more distant, it increases the use of moral decoupling. So can you put those into layman's terms?
Yes, for sure. As we said, in the earlier hypothesis, we saw that the risk associated with it is generally higher than the benefit you can get out of just taking a stand. When we are just looking at the fact of whether somebody took a stand and what stand they took. Now, if the risk is higher, what are the different ways brands can engage in issues while reducing the risk? So that is from where we kind of thought about it and came up with this section of the paper. So what we see here is, where is the actual activism originating often is different for different brand in practice. In some cases, you would see there is a particular CEO who is widely popular, and through his or her words, statements in the media and all, that is where you associated the brand with a particular issue. Sometimes it comes in the form of official statements from the brand or official actions from the brand. Or sometimes it might be just some brand ambassador, some celebrity endorser who did something. And since they're associated with your brand kind of gets associated with the whole activism, the whole issue and all.
So if we're talking about the gun control issue, which, as we had said, or as you had mentioned earlier, is a polarizing issue. If you have something like Dick's Sporting Goods decides we are not going to carry this rifle, that's a very close association because the brand is doing something.
Exactly.
As opposed to Chick-fil-A, where the CEO said some things, I believe they were pejorative around homosexuality, but that could be seen just as a personal statement versus a corporate statement. Is that right?
Exactly. So in such cases, we want to see to what extent people can separate the quality or the performance of a particular brand versus the morality associated with the brand. And what we would expect here based on this hypothesis is, if the statement comes from a CEO on a personal capacity during an interview or some other setting, or a celebrity endorser doing something in his personal time, that would allow consumers to psychologically differentiate between the what they feel is the immoral activity versus the quality or the performance of the brand or its products. So as the distance increases, for example, if it comes, as you say, took the example of Dick's Sporting Goods, it's very hard to differentiate between that action and the brand, right? Versus
right, because the brand is actively doing that thing. Okay.
Versus if the CEO is doing it, yes, we know the CEO is the mainly one of the main decision makers in the company, but it might be his personal opinion. And I, maybe as a consumer, I shouldn't punish all the brand because it will affect the employees and others who did not who may not share this opinion.
Right. So does this then have an implication as to how a brand might want to manage the situation? You know, how worried a brand should be if they inadvertently find themselves in hot water?
Exactly. And what is interesting is, even for a single individual, so you know, because we were talking about the example of a CEO making a statement, or in some cases, it's the ex-CEO or a former founder making a statement, how it is reported in the media, that also matters. In some cases, you right. see, even when Bill Gates would make a statement, it would be to make sure everybody can identify who that person is. The headline in different news articles would mention the name of founder of Microsoft made such a statement.
So they draw, even though he's speaking not on the capacity, yes, not in the capacity.
Now may not be associated with the company at all. But the way it is reported in the media, that also matters, whether there is an active connection being drawn versus not.
Fascinating.
So in that case, the public relations part of it becomes important to make sure the message is managed in a way so that the clear distinction between the person and the brand is highlighted.
Right. Fascinating. Just curious, generally speaking, is it good for people to understand moral reasoning strategy? Will that help them, you know, the consumer's moral reasoning strategy more broadly, just so that they can understand any, you know, spin doctoring that needs to happen? Or is this pretty much enough, as long as they understand this kind of thing, a brand understands what they need to?
So there are two main ways people kind of try to rationalize or justify supporting or keep using a brand which has taken a stand that they don't necessarily support. And these two strategies in moral psychology, we call the first is moral rationalization, and the second one is called moral decoupling. The primary difference between the two, if I want to keep it very simple, is in moral rationalization, you try to rephrase the whatever they have done to say that, hey, you know, it's actually not that immoral. Because
I really want to use the product.
Yes, because, you know, all the companies are doing it. It might be, so if we take the example of a lot of brands who were who got associated with child labor in their supplier locations in many developing or poor countries. So when you try to kind of use that brand, the logic that often comes is, yes, they did a bad thing, but you know, in their business and in those countries, a lot of companies are doing that. And that's how it goes. So in their context, it's actually not that immoral.
Mm.
So there is a rephrasing by changing the context, by changing that others do it. You make that, you try to say the act is not immoral in some way.
Right.
Whereas in decoupling, you actually acknowledge that this is an immoral thing that they're doing. But you try to differentiate the morality versus what we say, the performance or the quality aspect of it.
Right.
So at the same place, you can do both. And what we say is, in case of brand activism, the decoupling takes place. Because when an issue is so polarizing in our daily life for everybody's own identity, keep being consistent with their stand on the issue is very important. So it will be hard for them to say that, you know, that position on the issue of immigration is not actually moral. But
right.
they need to be able to say that is immoral, but still I support it because the immorality of their actions on that front is separate from the quality of their products.
Right. So we're on the last and very related hypotheses, and I'll just read them. In the case of consumer brand agreement regarding the brand stand, public backlash has a positive effect on consumers' attitudes toward a brand. And in the case of both consumer brand agreement and disagreement regarding a brand stand, a retraction and apology for the stand in response to public backlash has a negative effect on consumers' attitudes about the brand. So let's, if you can simplify that, maybe with an example so that people can follow all of the negative, positive pieces.
Yes. So let's focus on cases where a brand has taken a stand and I, as a consumer, agree with the stand taken by the brand. Now, as stated in hypothesis, the first hypothesis that we discussed, that we tested, that just because you have taken a stand that I agree with, it does not significantly increase my attitude towards a brand or my intention of using the particular brand. What we find is, though, the public reaction to the initial act of activism can change this. Specifically, when we see that a brand is getting a lot of backlash for taking a stand that I believe in.
I see.
That is where people's first sign of supporting the brand comes into play. This happens because when you are getting attacked for taking a moral stand that I believe in, that's not only the brand getting attacked, that's also that particular moral value getting attacked, and you getting attacked makes me feel closer to my in-group, and I'm there to support my in-group. So this is the only
case
where we find that brand activism can actually have a positive effect on consumers. And this is why, in most cases that become popular in the media about such instances of activism, we see such backlash, right? And that is why we see this instances of support.
Well, it's interesting because, for instance, let's talk about Nike and Colin Kaepernick and how, if the initial hypothesis of them, if I'm an in-group and I believe, you know, taking a knee and I think that's fine, I just assume that that's how they should feel. So it doesn't really do much good for Nike. However, then if there's a huge backlash against them taking this stand, it actually creates the very thing they're trying to stop, right? I mean,
Exactly. However, we should qualify here that even in this case, the positive effect is much, much weaker than the negative effect of those who are disagreeing with you.
Fascinating. Well, and then the corollary then, which I found fascinating, was that if you retract if you put your foot in it, like exactly. So had Nike been like, whoopsie, we didn't really mean to do that, that would have been negative for everybody. Everybody exactly. would have been like, you have no morals. What is that?
This is why this is such a tricky issue for brands to consider, because as I just said, you get the support when others are protesting against you and all. That is where consumers are ready to come out and kind of show some support from the brand, because this is where an in-group member is being attacked for our moral values that we share. And in that moment, if you abandon that moral value and you go back and saying, hey, you know, we are withdrawing our statement and all, that's like you are quitting the group at the moment the group is under threat. So that is almost like an act of betrayal.
But how come it doesn't appeal to the other group? I mean, let's say your market.
So you mean to say, so in case of those who disagreed with you, why doesn't it change their minds?
Right. For instance, why is it just there's no upside to apology?
So we might qualify here that whatever effects that we are talking about here are not effects in the long run, whereas effects in relatively short run. These are not effects for 3 to 5 years, because if you do not apologize, that stays with you for years and years and years.
I see. Okay.
So that is literally, when people term it as damage control, that is literally that controls the damage that you might have in future.
But I see.
At the short time, and because as we initially talked about, that these morality is very central to our identity, right? And there has been enough evidence in research that identity-based judgments tend to be very sticky. Just because you have apologized for your act, the next day everything doesn't go back to normal. It's really sticky for a long time. That initial, whatever action that you did, that sticks for a very, very long time. So you can't just change minds, but it's often just damage control for the long run.
One of the things I found really interesting in your study was that people value the morality of a brand differently than the product information related to the brand. And that was, exactly. And if I understood the research properly, learning a negative moral story about a brand has greater impact than learning a negative product aspect. Is that right?
Yes. This is very important because, you know, normally also we know when it comes to word of mouth in digital media and everywhere else, that negative word of mouth travels faster than a positive word of mouth, right? So there is a general negativity bias that we see in evaluations. But when it comes to morality, it goes much beyond that. And this is because of what we talked about, that when it comes to a moral domain, our whole focus on avoiding negative behavior or getting associated with negative behavior, in the example of the cocktail party, getting associated with the person who is stealing the ashtray in any way whatsoever. So that kind of drives, that person gets identified as somebody who is a thief, who steals right. things. So even in the next two parties, they don't steal something, it doesn't go away from your mind very quickly.
Right. So another question I had is, are these fundamental human behaviors or are there cultural variations? I mean, does this really go to, you know, human group behavior?
Yes. To specify, in our case, we surveyed all our respondents were from either US or from France. So our context of the study is pretty much these Western cultures.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any reason to believe it would be different for other cultures. But again, I don't have the data to confidently say that.
Right.
But there is no reason for that. Also, we should mention here that the effects that we are talking about here are relevant for consumer product. So we are fully focusing on the B2C products, mostly inexpensive products where there are alternative brands in the market for people to quickly switch to.
Uh-huh.
So for example, we studied, say, stationery brands, pizza delivery, chocolates, soft drinks,
mm-hmm.
These kind of products. But as you can imagine, if you have a car and that company takes a different stand, you can't just give up your car the next day, or most people cannot, at least, right?
Well, is that where we moral rationalization comes in? Because it's more challenging for me to swap out, and therefore I'm going to find a way to stay?
Exactly. So this is something we do not empirically test in this paper, but we mention as one of the possibilities that when it comes to such very expensive things, so people will find a way to cope with them in some way or the other. And that is where moral rationalization can come into play.
This is so interesting. Are there trends or research that we should keep on the lookout for that you've got in progress right now?
One of the things, as you mentioned, which we are currently studying is the intercultural aspect of it. Because there are many, many brands right now, they're, even if they do something in the US, they are present in different areas of the world, right? And how that affects them in different contexts. And especially, we talked about the moral decoupling, where if a CEO makes a statement, in many cases, people are able to differentiate that from the brand's performance or the product's performance. Now, this is a specifically might be a culturally sensitive issue, because there are many, many cultures where which are more collectivist, they see everything in a more interdependent way, where whenever you get associated with it, everything that has come in touch with that kind of an issue may become a taboo. So we are exploring those kind of areas.
Oh, that's fascinating. When do you anticipate publishing around that?
So this will most probably be next year. We are in the process. We are finalizing kind of the data collection for that. There are many other people who are working on similar areas. There has been work by others on how this affects a company's even firm value or stock returns. Or how are CMOs looking at it? All of these are very fascinating areas of research where people are working on.
This is so interesting. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking my production team at Up Next, my friend Rob Naughton, the voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, all of you, the members of our audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next time right here on Up Next.